tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's good to see people coming all the way from Toronto and Ottawa, other places, to come for this retreat. That's what I was hoping would happen. And the idea of this retreat is to try to create something where people can come at any time, practice with us at whatever time they have free, and also that there's no cost involved. And this is my sense of what a monastery can offer the laity, is a place to practice and teachings, which are always available if it's happening, and it's always with a spirit of generosity. And that's the way Theravada Buddhism has always functioned. It's always through generosity of heart of everyone involved. And obviously I would love to have a nice meditation hall where you feel nice and cozy and comfy and all that, but I think this is the best way to build a meditation hall, is just to start and practice and see if the devas are interested in us. Because building a meditation hall is something bigger than our local community could possibly do. But the local community practice, us here together, we do create, I think, the goodness, the barami, the good intention, the wholesome aspiration, which are the causes for goodness to come. You know, goodness begets goodness. And this sincere effort that we're making and enduring a bit of hardship, it's not that hard. These are very wholesome things that somehow attract goodness. People are inspired by goodness. Devas are inspired by goodness. So even if you're facing difficulties in your meditation and you can't follow, can't stay awake, or there's a lot of unfinished material, realize that just the bearing witness to that and being willing to take responsibility for your own mind and living within a discipline like this is very meritorious. It's very good, it's very wholesome, and leads to good results. Sometimes we don't see that when our meditations are difficult. Certainly when I was my early years in Thailand, I had a lot of very heavy states of mind and a lot of confusion and a lot of old angers and resentments that came through consciousness, and it was very hard to see that there was any point to it all. It just seemed like this, like one of those hills where you get to a crest and yet you see more of the hill, and then you get to the next crest and there's more of the hill, and you get to the next crest. It's just like endless struggle sometimes. So one has to have the sense of, you need a lot of strength to do this work. You need a lot of perseverance just to keep at it. Fortunately, I lived in Thailand. I had a very good context for dealing with these things, very supportive teachers and lay people, and a whole culture which praised the aspiration to Nibbana, praised the keeping of precepts, praised the discipline of a monastic. So there was always that moral support for me. I know lay life sometimes can be a very lonely affair in terms of developing Dhamma practice. Sometimes lay people are in work situations where it's maybe weird to be a meditator, I'm not sure, but the reflective, contemplative life perhaps isn't encouraged, more worldly energies are there, so it can be a much more lonely and isolated kind of practice in some environments. So hopefully a monastery like this helps a little bit to help encourage you and to do the practice. I've been on this retreat, I've been suggesting various things from my own understanding. One is to cultivate the perception of change as a way of grounding yourself into the present moment with the way things are. And the perception of change, briefly, the perception of change points to the knowing of the way things are. Desire points and seeks the qualities of the way things are. So to unpack that, the perception of change, if I listen to sound and I just hold my attention in listening and I listen to change, I don't know about you, but because I'm observing change, my mind recedes from engaging in the qualities and stands as the knowing which knows change. So when I do that, I don't know about you, when I emphasize that as a present practice, to listen, then what that emphasizes me is the knowing or the awareness. Now the other, when I'm concerned about the qualities, let's say I'm looking at the thermostat and I'm checking the temperature and I want it to be warmer and I don't like the cold, I want it to be warmer, then that draws me into the qualities, doesn't it? So that, I need both. I need to know the qualities of my experience to live skillfully. But if I'm going to have any spiritual dimension to my life, I also have to have a way I emphasize awareness of qualities. Because if my only strategy in life is to constantly rearrange the qualities of life, the qualities of my environment, my social situation, my physical comfort, and so on, then I am... What's the word? I am... By default, I'll never realize the spiritual quality because I'm looking in that which is not, which is material, which is changing, which is contingent, which is dependent on circumstance, which I don't have control over, which arises and ceases according to all kinds of causes and conditions. So I need to live in the world in a skillful way where I manipulate conditions to the best of my ability to live, to have enough food, and to have shelter, and pay the insurance, and make sure that, you know, have my winter tires on, and, you know, all practical things of life. So we do that. But then the other, too, to emphasize the awareness rather than the objects of awareness, okay? Both we need to do. So on a retreat, you know, we try to set the situation up where you don't have to worry about the objects. You might not, you know, you might feel you want it warmer and so on and so forth, but you don't really need to manipulate anything. You have this opportunity just to observe how you react to the objects of sense experience, so to the people around you, to the environment, to the sounds, to the bed you're sleeping in, whatever it is, the temperature. You see how you react to those objects and see if you can sustain awareness of change. And begin to understand the desire to change the objective world into some kind of pattern which is always comfortable and suitable to your needs. So not rejecting, you know, the objective world, but finding a place of refuge and peace and awareness which is not dependent on that which is changing. So that's the kind of basic understanding I hope I've been getting across. I don't know. Giving it a go. So desire emphasizes the qualities. Awareness of change emphasizes the knowing. And this knowing is not intellectual, it's existential. When I say I know the sound of the room, there's a discernment, a presence, but it's not a thought. I'm not thinking it's loud or it's soft. I go, before I think about it, it's this way. And there's listening. So in that sense, then, all objects, point to this knowing. If you're contemplating change. So if I feel happy and elated, a point, and I'm contemplating change, happiness and elation are pointing to the knowing. If I feel like not getting anywhere in the meditation, I sort of kind of like it's not working, or I feel a bit confused, if I'm contemplating change, then that confusion or sense of not getting anywhere, that also points to the knowing. Yeah? It's the same knowing, it's the same awareness. If I'm emphasizing the perception of change, and that I need to encourage all the time. If, however, in that same example, I'm emphasizing the quality of my experience, so I feel quite elated and happy for some period of some meditation, and I'm emphasizing the quality, then of course I want to repeat that, because it's pleasant. And because I want to repeat it, I try to control my mind to manufacture that, or I try to get rid of things which don't fit that pattern of desire which I've held on to. So when the feeling of not being happy or being confused by my meditation, because I'm emphasizing the quality, and the desire is kind of wanting a certain quality, it wants the pleasant, not the unpleasant, then I suffer. Now that's not an absolute. Like, if the temperature drops to, you know, -10, I'm not going to stay in here. I'm out of here. I'm going to my duvet. So it's not kind of an absolute philosophy, you know, that thou, you know, you must take all unpleasurable situations and sit through them, come hell or high water, until you realize nibbana. That'd be absurd. But it's just pointing to the conventions that we live by, but also pointing to something which is so close to us that we miss it, that there is always this possibility of knowing change. And so I've been encouraging on this retreat, can you try to sustain awareness of change for longer periods of time? And then I also talked about, like, uncertainty, how Lumpa Cha would not just emphasize the perception of change, but also the very uncertainty of our perceptions, our judgments, things like that. So that's, to me, quite basic in understanding the Buddha's path. So in terms of, like, meditation, the objects of sense which then distract us are the objects which we get attached to. So we were talking about energy, dullness, restlessness, and then various kind of fantasies which are pleasant to the mind, or resistance to various like bodily aches and pains. These keep us preoccupied, and because they are quite often very powerful, we get lost in them, don't we? You know, we get lost in sleepiness and drowsiness, or we get into a fantasy and then the bell rings and you kind of realize, wow, it was a 20-minute fantasy I just went on. Just took a trip to Thailand or somewhere, and we realize, okay, it's quite hard to first of all remain present. It's not an easy thing. So we train by making suggestions. Okay, no, I'm not going to do fantasy this retreat. I'm just going to try to be present to the way things are. And we keep making these suggestions to the mind, and these suggestions are the seeds for present moment awareness. They're not like dogmatic imperatives or like tyrannical demands, you should be a better meditator, but they're just right suggestions or right thought. No, present moment awareness. So the mind starts to fantasize about some trip, I'm going to go to the Cayman Islands or something like that, and you think, no, just here now, and that gentle suggestion awakens one to the fantasies. So it's not an aversion to fantasy, just that suggestion of an alternative, what I'm going to do, that sets the seed for more awareness. I'm more aware of the tendency to fantasize, or worry, or whatever it might be. So this is right thinking or right intention. You can keep dropping into consciousness the suggestions to awaken. Now, they're not the suggestions to get rid of, the suggestions to awaken. That's very important. Okay, so there's that. So what I wanted to talk about a bit is stress, and because I realize we all feel stress in our lives, and how to use stress as a meditative object. Now, the best thing to do with stress is to have a vacation. So go visit the Cayman Islands. Okay, so that's a possibility which isn't in the realm of possibility for many of us. So, plan B. Drop out and become a monk. Or a nun. Okay? But then we have limited kuti, so keep your day job. So those are kind of possibilities. But then in the normal course of events, even in monasteries, you have stress. So how to, like, what, you know, how does stress arise? Well, for me, it arises either that I'm overworked and I get too many demands on my time to answer questions and to deal with things. How should we do this? Should we do that? How should we do this? How should we do that? Da, 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 da. So, or have to pump out a lot of energy to do things. So teaching takes quite a bit of energy. And so I reach a point where, you know, the inputs are so much that I start to get averse. So then my hackles go up. And I say, biting things to my friends, and they back off. It's a very good strategy. Like, the boss is in a bad mood. So that's a strategy which is not very pleasant for me or anyone else. Right? But you see it arise. You're tired, you know, you're exhausted, and then the information keeps coming at you. And lots of times we can't do anything about it. We just have to bear witness to it, right? We just have to deal with it, you know, or we get fired or whatever it is. And so we push it all down into our hearts. You know, we bite our tongue. We bear with the arrogant boss who is domineering, or we bear with some situation which we just have no power over. It's just bigger than us. And we go home, we're stressed out. You know, we've got the stuff in our minds. And so that's one way it might work. Another way is worry. You know, where you know, there's so many possibilities of failure or disaster or complexity coming out in the mind, just keeps worrying. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if this happens? What if that happens? And the mind gets stressed by worry. And you'll have your own ways. You'll define that. But I think one of the obviously important things to take a vacation if you can, to get a new boss, to have less work, and so on and so forth. So, if you can do it, great. Okay, less is better. But if you can't, then you have to. Seems to me, you have to make some kind of time where you can begin to process the stress. If you make no time to process the stress, I think it's very dangerous, isn't it? And that, of course, leads to burnout. And burnout is serious. Burnout comes some repair work. You know, stress, you can kind of, at a certain extent, you can repair it through your daily maintenance practice of meditation. But burnout, that, at least my experience, if that takes, that really impacts you, where your psyche gets so off balance that you really need a lot of work to balance it out. At least that's been my experience. So it's called retreat time, long retreat time. So if the stress is so bad where you're just always yelling at people or breaking into crying and all that time, meditation's not going to help much, because the work situation is just too much. What you do about that, I don't know. Come and stay here for a week or two, whatever, I don't know. But anyway, the more normal kind of stuff that we have, seems to me that the antidote for me is going to the heart, because my stress goes to the head. So aversion is in the head, like, get off my back, will you? Or, I don't want to do this anymore. Or, so it's like aversion, push it away, get out of here. And then a worry also is very up in the head. What am I going to do? What's going to happen? Will that work out? Well, I don't know. What if I do this? What if I do that? You know, mind just kind of racing away. And that's in the head too. So I find if I, because I like to do a lot of body awareness practice, that if I really, you know, I do, I've learned to be very aware of the heart chakra in a very visceral way. And so thinking about that, that the practices of kindness that we do in Buddhism, sometimes they are left very kind of cerebral, intellectual. You know, may I be well, may George be well, may Sam be well, may the Queen of England be well, you know, kind of going through various kind of... Everyone done Queen of England lately? I do it in English, I suppose. But anyway, so I have maybe people, and it remains intellectual very easily. You know, it's thought, which is good. It's good because it's setting up alternative suggestions to the mind. But there's also kindness in our heart, which is very tender, isn't it? If you think of a child, like the image I was giving of a child with a drawing, and the child, you know, is 4 years old, is very proud of the drawing, and very happy, and this beautiful tenderness, it evokes this beautiful tenderness in your heart, isn't it? It's, oh, yeah, that's really lovely drawing. The innocence of the child and the kind of whole possibility. And that's a whole different way of kindness, isn't it? It's more of the body. It's also in perception, but it's very much in the body and in the heart, very much in the heart. So I think to try to access that kind of kindness, for me, is a way of moving away from the thinking mind. So if I'm getting stressed out, first of all I just try to balance my calendar more, which I'm always struggling with. So that's just kind of practical stuff. But having said that, then when I do feel stressed out, I try to see, okay, this is practice now. Okay, you're not balanced, mate. Come on, you know, what are you going to do about it? Rather than, oh, poor me, you know, I've got too much work. That's useless. I mean, I'll go there. I'll feel sorry for myself, but I know it's useless. But it's just kind of, okay, this is what the way it is now. What do I need to do? You know, what's the practice? And so, like, you know, pragmatic. What's the craft now? What are the baramis I need to develop? What kind of character traits do I need to develop right now with this mindset? And the thing about our, you know, the stress that we do have, it's usually, you know, the patterns usually are pretty common, aren't they? I mean, I might get stressed by different things, but the whole manifestation of stress, either as aversion or worry, usually it's the same kind of stuff, right? So I don't have to, personally, I don't have to analyze it much. Oh, I know, okay, there's that one. All right, it's back again. Okay, what can I do with it? How can I be skillful with this now? How can I take this on and become a stronger person through it? And that's very helpful, that attitude, isn't it? Now I'm not, you know, I'm still practical, you know, still know my limits, but I'm also like, you know, like an athlete taking on a good challenge, or a mountain climber or a craftsperson taking on a difficult piece of wood or whatever, that thing, okay, how do I do this? And then that attitude is bringing you into an inquiry now. The stress and habit is kind of going into head and complaining and so on. No, what's it really like now to feel stressed? So I make conscious the feeling of being stressed. And so there's resistance to life. I don't want this moment. I want out of here. So you begin to see resistance. Yeah, resistance feels this way. And then like taking, I find, just like going to the heart and just chanting, what would tenderness feel like now, right? And then the mind goes, goes into thought again, and then back, and just literally going from the head to the heart, going from the head to the heart, to the heart, to the heart, until it settles into the heart. And that's very relaxing. It's very relaxing. It's really ease. It eases your stress. It eases your consciousness. And then, you know, as soon as someone comes in the room, get out of here! You still react, but now you see the reaction more. And now you kind of see it in contrast to, you see the heart closing and the mind resisting, right? And then if you get really skilled at it, you have a kind of secondary consciousness operating in your heart, background attention operating through your heart. So you kind of feel the stress coming on, you feel the reaction, oh, no, in the heart, in the heart. And there's limits to that. You know, sometimes it's just like, you know, just tell people to drop dead and get out of there. But sometimes you can't, because socially it would be a bit awkward if you did at a committee meeting or something. Can't do it. But I like just the idea of taking on even more difficult situations as practice. You could say, well, when this is so stressful, I can't practice. Okay, you can do that. It's true to some extent. But if you're there and you got no choice, what are you going to do? Better take it the other way around. Again, if a person's getting burned out, I agree. Sometimes the situation is too stressful and there is no chance for mindfulness. And that's where we need to help each other as much as we can. You know, when some person is just reacting, then you can't just go to them, oh, just be more mindful. You know, like if someone is in a monastery and I just see they're getting burnt out, I don't go up to them and say, your mindfulness isn't strong. That would be really cruel. You know, try to protect them and give them less responsibility and help them out that way. And Buddhism is always this kind of reasonable practice. It's not like absolute. You know, you have to face everything. So it seems to me when you can develop these kinds of strengths is when you're not so stressed out. Yeah? So in just in the ordinariness of mundane existence, just like learning to first of all move away from thinking into the body, moving away from, you know, like being awake to like a constant criticizing of life, to more an empathetic attitude to life. And these are ongoing trainings of the heart, which if we don't engage with them in the less stressful parts of life, we won't have the reserves and strengths to bring them up when life does become stressful. So that's important, isn't it? So that's why we always talk about daily life practice, you know, doing these things again and again, meditations throughout your week, bringing it up, and then kind of deliberately taking on things like that. You know, the very problems of your existence are the places of edification. You don't gain the strength of patience with when everything's going your way. You don't develop endurance when you're getting everything you want. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it? It's obvious. But when you get life the way you don't want it, does one, you know, do we have the maturity and mindfulness to say, oh, this is practice now. This is practice. And some things we're very good at and some things we're not good at. So the things where you do get kind of really lost into or that are overwhelming, then you just keep encouraging yourself. Just encourage, okay, that's an area where I really lose mindfulness. Maybe it's around a person, like a particular person just kind of confuses you, or some social situation that's very complex and you walk away getting confused. Then you just make the intention, all right, in those situations, I'm going to try to be more mindful of my body. And that's very helpful. Like if maybe you have to go, like, for some people, Christmas is a joy, and some people, Christmas is very stressful. You know, you meet up with people in your family, you meet once a year, and maybe family life wasn't such a very harmonious and happy situation for you, and you come to Christmas dinner, and it's very tense and very unfortunate and so on and so forth, and you dread it, oh God, Christmas is coming, or Thanksgiving, whatever, and so Thanksgiving becomes a horse or whatever, that's the worst of it. It might be very beautiful, you know, very hard, but let's say there is something that you are going to face socially that's going to be stressful, and you know it's going to be stressful, you can start stressing out 2 weeks before and worrying about it, and as soon as you notice that, that's when you go to the body. So your mind's saying, oh God, Auntie Mabel, I don't know I can face her again. No, last Christmas, you know. And you say, no, that's worry, right there, that's stress. And then your mind wants to go to the thinking, And then you bring your attention to the heart. What is it like, you know? Try to bring tenderness to your heart. Not to be, and like, kind of intellectually, you can say, oh, I'll be fine, you know, Auntie Mabel, may she be well. That's okay, too. But try to go to the body and like the real softness of the heart. So that then when that, you know, the situation is coming up and you start to worry about it even more, maybe, like a job interview or something like that, you go back to the heart. Or you have to give tomorrow's talk here. But you haven't heard that. We're going to pass a hat around. And we're going to put everyone's names in the hat. We'll draw the hat and you can give the talk. So imagine if you had to do that, right? You'd be in the library. Kidding. Oh, which talk should I do?
A lot of silence.
Venerable Kemiko went to teach at the Quaker house today. So he was asking him in the office, what are we talking about? He says, well, I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm practicing not worrying. And it's true, isn't it? So you take that. And that's why, you know, like in this retreat, I was saying, really know the mood of the mind. What was the mood of the mind like? And then practice with the mood of the mind. And then a social situation, sure, if you need to do, what do they call that? When you project something, a PowerPoint. I've never done a PowerPoint retreat. If you have to do a PowerPoint, fine. You know, you do that kind of stuff. But just to watch. And so this is a chance now to look at the stress of worry and then use the body. Really, you know, get to know the body in that way. It's very, very helpful. I won't do the hat on you, I promise. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection.
Andamayang dhammagataya sadhu karang dadamase.